You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina, and globally at WPVMFM.org.
From Feature Story News in Brussels, I'm William Denslow. The United States says it struck Iranian military sites over the weekend. Meanwhile, Kuwait said it had responded to Iranian missiles and drones. It comes as President Donald Trump claims that Tehran wants to make a deal, urging his critics to, quote, sit back and relax. China's Coast Guard says it's conducted law enforcement patrols in waters east of Taiwan. The patrols are in response to plans by Japan and the Philippines to launch maritime border delimitation talks. Laura Westbrook reports from Hong Kong.
China's Coast Guard says a flotilla had carried out the patrol in accordance with the law to the east of Taiwan, though it did not specify where exactly. It called it a necessary action in response to Japan and the Philippines announcing they would start talks in defining the maritime boundary of their exclusive economic zones and continental shelves in accordance with international law. Although both countries did not provide detailed information about the exact area under discussion, China argues that the negotiations involve waters east of Taiwan, which Beijing considers part of its territory. Taiwan's foreign ministry says Beijing has no right to interfere in Taiwan's territorial sovereignty or its maritime rights. China claims most of the South China Sea. That's despite legal precedents and competing claims from countries including Vietnam, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Malaysia.
Political tensions are rising in Hungary after the president refused to resign by a deadline set by the prime minister. Pablo Guterres reports from Budapest.
Hungary's president Tamás Szurjók said he will stay in office and argued that leaving now would not resolve the constitutional dispute between the presidency and the government. He said that any change should happen through legal steps and in line with Hungary's constitution. Magyar had given Szurjók until May 30 to step down, saying the president remained tied to the political network of former Prime Minister Viktor Orbán and no longer represented national unity. After the deadline passed, Magyar said he planned to meet Szurjók on Monday at the presidential palace.
The European Union's foreign affairs chief has arrived in Islamabad for talks aimed at advancing cooperation under the Pakistan-EU strategic dialogue. Hira Mustafa reports from Islamabad.
During the session, both sides are expected to review bilateral relations and cooperation across multiple sectors. The strategic dialogue represents the highest level of institutionalized engagement between the two sides. The top European diplomat is also scheduled to meet the president, prime minister, and the country's army chief.
And the prime minister of the Czech Republic has announced that it's unlikely the country will hit its NATO spending targets for this year. It comes as the military alliance is under increased pressure to ramp up spending on defense. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks. Today, the spread of Ebola from the Democratic Republic of Congo to Uganda and possibly now also to southern Sudan. More than 40 people are already dead. The number of infections is soaring and concerns are growing about whether the outbreak can be contained. Christian Lindmeier is spokesperson for the World Health Organization.
The problem is a multifold here. First, it's a very remote area. It's a mining area with lots of activity going on, people going back and across the front across the borders. Then it's a rebel area, partly related to the mining activities and the control over this territory, but all this area is between several rebel groups. It's a civil war going on. That means many areas cannot be accessed. It's very remote, meaning it's 1,700 kilometers by air from Kinshasa, the capital. It's nearly 3,000 kilometers by road. Aid cuts have been decimating the ability of folks in of health clinics, of health posts, not enough equipment available. All that has to be urgently shipped in now into an area which is a dangerous zone, which is remote. So it's a big, big, big cocktail.
Tomorrow, we're going to look in more detail at those cuts in humanitarian aid that he mentioned. They originated with the Trump administration and have hit the Democratic Republic of Congo very hard.
The main news again. The US says it struck Iranian military sites over the weekend. Meanwhile, Kuwait said it responded to Iranian missiles and drones. Political tensions are rising in Hungary after the president refused to resign by a deadline set by the prime minister. And the European Union's top foreign policy officials have arrived in Islamabad for talks aimed at advancing cooperation under the Pakistan-EU strategic dialogue. And that's the latest feature story news. William Denslow reporting.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Partly sunny today, a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high near 80. Chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight under mostly cloudy skies, a low around 57 here in the city. Partly sunny on Tuesday, a chance of showers with a high near 70. Partly cloudy for Tuesday night with a low in the upper 40s to near 50. Then on Wednesday, we'll see sunny skies and a high near 76. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WPBM 103.7, the voice of Asheville, independent, commercial-free radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant, behavioral health expert. With me today, I have a colleague and now friend, Mr. Jordan Lewis, attorney and mental health parity advocate with JML Law. Jordan is a 1979, we're going to try not to date him too bad, 1979 graduate of Williams College in Williamstown, Mass., where he was an All-American swimmer. After years in the Daily News World, he started a law school. He started law school at the University of Minnesota. Post-graduation, he worked for Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Cressy, now one of the most successful plaintiffs' law firms in the country.
That's true.
In 1992, Jordan started working with a small Minneapolis-based commercial law firm known as Siegel Brill and honed his practice over the next 20 years until moving to Fort Lauderdale, Florida with his family in 2012 to work with Kelly Ustahl, a preeminent plaintiffs' law firm there in Southern Florida. This was a complete circle for Jordan, leading to opening Jordan Lewis PA in 2016, JML Law. But the specialty of his practice is what we're here to talk about. And his personal story connects him to the world of recovery in an incredibly profound way, which I am grateful that I got to sit and listen to just in an intimate lunch setting and connect with you, Jordan. Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Todd. Appreciate the introduction. You nailed it.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you, parity law and, you know, kind of the denials management and just the whole world of people being able to go to treatment, get their insurance, do what they're supposed to be doing and pay for it is kind of one of my big, advocacy points. I try to help families navigate that as much as possible and do things like set a budget for how much they're going to pay for recovery. But, I think that the real special part of your story is your personal journey, being connected to recovery and the family members. And I want to talk about the practice and some of the things that you're doing today, but I also want to, if you care to share it, I'd love for you to tell at least a little bit about your personal story and how it relates to recovery.
Sure. It's a story that is married to my professional practice. It's not possible for me to divorce them. It's why I opened my own little law firm, and it's why 90% of my practice, at least, it focuses on helping families get insurance coverage for mental health and chemical treatment services. I was married in 1997. That's not right. It's 87. Wow.
a little different.
Yeah. 87. So anyway, we are the parents of three daughters. They call kids who were born within the same calendar year Irish twins. My kids were, we kicked out three girls in 4 years. I don't know what that makes them. They're not quite Irish twins, but that's still pretty rapid production. all three had or have mental health challenges. My youngest died in 2016. She had really profound mental health issues, anorexia, suicide ideation. She had a very, very complicated imaginary world that kind of dominated a lot of her adolescence. She did not die directly from her illness. She was living at home with us. And at the age of 22, you don't get to have any say in medical care. So she had a pain in her leg that she went to see urgent care about 3 times. We didn't even know about it. And it turned out to be a blood clot that eventually got loose and entered her lungs and killed her within seconds. And after she died, we found a script for an MRI in her bedroom that she never went to. She never used.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, your life flips when you lose a child. And certainly ours right. did. It's hard. I'm not unique in this story, but it's still a hard story. My middle daughter, is a recovering alcoholic. Of my 3 kids, she's the only one who served time.
a lot of crying, right?
That's true. She has completely turned her life around. She's been sober for more than a decade. She's married to a great guy who she met in recovery. She is 7 months pregnant. She is a practicing lawyer here in Florida and kicking ass and taking names. She has really found herself and is a huge resource for me. I lean on her more than I should.
What is her law practice? Like, what kind of law does she do?
I think this is pretty interesting. She went to the University of Miami Law School. She went from there and worked for 3 years as a public defender. And
honest work.
the reason she did it is that she understood what it was like to be on the other side of the table, behind bars. And that's a real tough job, emotionally. And she left after 3 years. She's now doing personal injury work for a boutique, really high-end law firm in Southern Florida, and finding it's really fun talking to her because she is, the growth curve for her is it's like a rocket ship. She's learning so much so fast, and she's getting really good, and you can watch it. And she's 7 months pregnant and just as excited as can be. The big debate is what I will be called as grandfather.
Right, right. That's that, you know, you have to settle that ahead of time, right?
Right. My kids loved to call me J Lou. and I've offered that as maybe that's what I should be called as a grandfather, but no, I think that was vetoed. Anyway, my oldest is has a 21-year drug use problem. It's been an absolute terror-filled roller coaster. It culminated a year ago. She was kind of bumping along, doing okay. She's a medical esthetician by trade, and had her own practice. She was living with a young man who she met in recovery. He overdosed. They both relapsed, sort of in slow motion together. He ended up dying in their apartment, July of 2023. And you could see her spiral. She just gave up. And this isn't textbook parenting, but we brought her home, and it required very little of her. We'd go to meetings and help us around the house, but until you can figure out how to process this grief, we are your soft landing. So it's now almost exactly a year ago on Friday, January 5th of 2024, she said that she was going to go to a meeting. I called her at about 8 o'clock on that night. And she immediately answered the phone and said, I'm in a meeting. I can't talk. And I said, just remember, we have some errands that we had agreed to do together the following morning. And she said, that's fine, Dad. Do you mind if I have pizza with some of the people at the meeting afterwards? And I said, she's a 33-year-old kid, at this, not a kid, grown up. And I that's not my job to regulate when she has pizza and with whom. So I said, let's just remember that we need to be productive the next morning. Anyway, so she wasn't home at 10 o'clock and she wasn't answering her phone. And she wasn't home at midnight and she wasn't answering her phone. And given the previous 7 months, both my wife and I knew. I actually bumped into a text message that I sent to her that night where I said goodbye. So my wife and I got up and walked the same walk we walked the night we lost my youngest, the step by step, because we thought we had lost my oldest. And we were out on the beach. I live 6 blocks from the beach at about 2:30 in the morning. And I get a phone call from a number I don't know. And there's a male voice who's somebody I don't know. And he asked me whether I was Jordan Lewis. And I said, yes. And he asked whether I was the father of Alana Lewis. And I said, yes. And he said, I just dropped her off at the hospital. I think she's dead. They were giving her CPR in the parking lot and ripping her clothes off, and I have her car. And I said, thank you. as I relive that, none of it surprised me. It was horrible, but I was expecting the call.
Standing outside of yourself, watching yourself receive a phone call, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. This and wondering, praying. Wondering how this can possibly be my life. So I wasn't in a hurry to call a hospital, and I didn't for probably 12 hours. And when I did, the hospital said that she had been in cardiac arrest for 15 minutes minimum. That's what they knew about. They didn't know about how much longer before she got to the hospital, but they knew that she was in cardiac arrest 15 minutes for 15 minutes. She was still alive. But they told me not to come to the hospital. They said, there's nothing for you to see here, and she won't know you're here. And I actually thought that was generous advice, charitable advice. And so we didn't go. The next day, again, this weird feeling that you're watching yourself make this call, I called the hospital and I asked whether my daughter was still alive, and the answer was yes. So we, as a family, went, and she was in a coma. Her body temperature had been reduced to 80 degrees to preserve the, organs. She was on a respirator. Her eyes were sometimes open, sometimes not. Sometimes it felt like she was making eye contact, but then the eyes would slip away. And the doctor came in and he said the most likely outcome was that she would never breathe without assistance again, because she couldn't voluntarily control her body. And if we took out the assistance, she would literally suffocate on a cough. She couldn't expel mucus.
Right.
Would she want to live like that? And of course the answer for is no.
Right.
So this is now Monday morning. By this time, my entire extended family was in my kitchen and we gathered around and decided that we were going to have to remove the respirator. And we talked among ourselves about who had to be there to watch her go, knowing that it could last 30 seconds or hours, maybe even longer. I don't know. That was, when you talk about sort of an otherworldly moment, that was the worst. You having a conversation about who needs to sit at her side to wait for her to die. Ultimately, everybody decided to be there, at least at the start. So we went there. to the hospital, which is about a 40-minute drive. And we walked in, and Alana's head perceptibly turned towards me. And our eyes made contact. And I looked at her, and I said, "Do you know who I am?" And she nodded, "Yes." And I said, "Do you know what happened?" And she nodded, "No." And you could see her trying to talk. The intubator is in her mouth.
Right.
And you could see her lips trying to form words around the mouthpiece. And the nurse is watching this and said, "How about if I take out the intubator?" And we said, "Is that safe?" And her answer was, "Who knows?" She said, "Go to the waiting room and I'll come get you." And 15 minutes later, she came and got us. And she said, "Your daughter would like to talk to you." And at this point, we're just swimming. We had already decided to put her remains next to the remains of my youngest.
Mm-hmm.
And just this amazing moment. We walked in, and it was like there was a 100-pound weight on her chest. She could barely move, and her hands were her arms were extended, and her hands were sort of clawed. But she was talking, and she was talking in a weird, monotone, high-pitched.
What happens when that intubator is in the
But she was talking, and there was no, one of the questions that is she all there mentally? And there was no obvious deficiency at all. And in the course of about 8 or 10 hours, on a day when we thought she was going to die, she came completely back to the point where she got up on her own and went to the bathroom and then came back and sat down on her bed. It was just this.
They declared her dead, though, too, right? She was actually declared dead. Is that right?
Well, she was in cardiac arrest for 15 minutes. They didn't stop working her. But, if you and I are in cardiac arrest for 15 minutes, there's nothing left. Yeah. There's nothing left. And I told you sort of her off-color joke. I hope you don't mind if I repeat it, which she said as she was coming out of this mess. Is it okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Please.
All right. So we're all gathered around her, and she's trying to make and she's emotionally a complete basket case. She's up and she's down and she's crying and weeping and laughing happily and then hysterically, which all makes sense to me, given her past 48 hours. So anyway, so she looks at me and said, "Wait a minute. I was dead." And I said, "Yeah, for 15 minutes, at least you were dead." And she said, "And now I'm alive." And I said, "Looks like it." And she said, "Was I resurrected?" And I said, I suppose that's what this is. And she said, "Am I Jesus?" And I said, "No, you are not Jesus." And not sure what you are, but that's not it.
That's not it.
Yeah. And she said, "No, I'm 33, just like Jesus. From now on, my pronoun is Jesus." Gosh. And my middle daughter is watching this exchange, and she looks at me and she said, "She's back." And she was back. It's still probably the most amazing 12 hours of my life to watch my daughter literally come back from.
To give her up.
Yeah.
And to
bury her.
And bury, in your mind, at least, bury her.
Yeah.
And decide where and make the plan and then turn around and walk into the hospital and be like, "What is going on?"
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard this story now. This is the second time. And I can't, I keep waiting for the punchline. You know what I mean? Still, right now.
Yeah. It's just a crazy story. The number of doctors and nurses who filed in to her room just to see it, because everybody thought she was gone. And that was sort of validation for me. This is not normal. This is a freaking miracle that I'm watching. And one of my takeaways is that she's probably of alien birth.
I think all parents feel that way sometimes, but yeah, you might be onto something. I don't know.
So at that point, you know, I'm not just a lawyer practicing in this area. I'm a parent living with this. And so I know about a law in Florida that permits a judge to order somebody to involuntary treatment. Yeah. And at the beginning of that day, I wasn't thinking that I needed a lawyer to do that.
You're talking about the Marchman Act, now the Baker Act, which is just plain old commitment. But Marchman is like, you got to finish, you know?
Right. So on Monday morning, I didn't think I needed the Marchman Act. I thought I needed to worry about how she was going, what her remains were going to go. So the hospital ended up discharging her on Wednesday. That's 2 days after she came out of the coma. And they wanted to discharge her the following day. They said there's nothing we can do for her now, which just seemed insane to me. But anyway, so we had a day or two to get a Marchman Act in order, and we decided this is a line. Once you cross this, once you die, everything is different.
Was she resistant even then to saying, no, I don't need treatment? Like, you got the Marchman Act to be safe, but you know. What was her disposition toward treatment at that time?
She knew her disposition was that it was going to be just like all the 20 plus other times she had gone to treatment. She's an expert, and she knew how to game the system. She knew the answers that people wanted. She knew that she knows very well that treatment is segmented into 30, 60, 90 days. She felt that she could handle 30, and that's all she needed. Right. Right.
Right.
And we knew that we were talking about years. Once you die, 30 days, I don't know that 30 days ever makes sense. I happen to know where the 30 days comes from. It's a complete contrivance. It has nothing to do with science or treatment efficacy. It was invented by insurance companies.
Yeah.
This is a round number.
It's the 19 early 90s managed care. You know, we're still operating within those timeframes to this day. Yeah.
Right. Even though it makes no sense. And I think all the practitioners know it. But in any case, we were not interested with a 30, 60, 90 day model. This obviously was different. And maybe she probably needed much, much longer term care before this event, but here we are. So anyway, we found a great lawyer. We got the Marchman Act in order. She was discharged to a sheriff's deputy on Wednesday night, 2 days after she came out of the coma, and she stroked while she was being discharged.
Jesus.
To the point where she couldn't talk, she couldn't move her arms. In some ways, she went right back to where she had been Sunday. Her eyes were open. She was conscious.
She was not there. Right.
But she was not there. So she was discharged by the hospital while this was happening, released to detox. The detox called us the next day and said they had brought her back to the hospital. And because they said she's not right. And I ended up back in the ER and caused a tremendous scene because she had been reassigned to the doctor who signed her discharge. And I thought,
tell me about it. Let's spend a minute on that. Because that story, here's what leads me to be in the role that I'm in as therapeutic consultant is ultimately, and one of my favorite things to do is for a hospital to realize that there's a person the hospitals typically refer to me as an advocate as opposed to a consultant. I'm an advocate. And one of my favorite things to do is to sit in a room full of doctors when they know an advocate is watching and run circles around them because they don't know jack about treatment. They know how to stabilize a person in a hospital setting, and they know how to prescribe meds. You know, I'll give them credit for their practice where practice credit is due. But outside of that, knowing about treatment and honestly, just having an investment in the longer term outcomes for a person's care, it's not there. They're not, and I'm not talking about all of them. I am talking about many. And certainly in hospitals, it's worse than pretty much any other setting. But you find doctors and nurses and clinical professionals, and social workers, case managers, and the whole nine yards that have either very little knowledge or very little investment or some level of both with regard to a person's long-term care outcome. And they don't know how to manage it. They're just trying to get, you know, they got beds are full. They got to get them out the door and everything else. And you've got a doctor who's signing off on orders, you know, the thousandth that day, I'm sure, whatever, right? And they're not paying attention. And then, and this is the part that really gets me. I get that people kind of, you get to a job and you can paint by numbers a bit. Like that makes sense to me that can happen. But you get in front of a doc and a parent is standing there, right? And you're standing there and you know your daughter and you know something's not right. You know something is happening, right? And they're not listening. They dismiss you. You're being dismissed at the door. And the thing that you have to do, please tell this story, what you did. I really want to hear.
Well, relating to that, if you and I were being discharged and couldn't speak and couldn't feed ourselves, we wouldn't have been discharged.
Right.
My oldest had told me many, many times that hospitals treat addicts differently. And I dismissed that. I thought, no way. That can't be true. But I watched it. She was discharged, and that her nurses knew that she couldn't speak and that she couldn't move her arms. And that wouldn't have happened to you or to me. So when I got back to the hospital, she was on a gurney in a hallway. Nobody was, if anybody was touching her, it was by accident because they would bump into her in the hallway. And I couldn't,
right.
Yeah. I couldn't find anybody who owned her, much less was treating her.
Right.
I made a scene.
I would have too. I mean, you know, come on, man.
I made a scene to the point where I had a security guard fumbling for his taser. And I looked at him and I said, unless you plan on advocating for my child, I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving. But this was, I think, an act of dumb luck or inspiration there. The administration building was next door to the ER and it was after hours. I didn't expect to see anybody there, but I had to do something. So I stormed into the administration building. Again, security should have stopped me, but I think they saw the crazy look in my eyes and just let me in. And I asked, as I fly past the security guard, I said, where's the hospital administrator? And he said, down the hall. And then he said, but he's gone for the day. And I said, okay, where are the lawyers? And he said, oh, they're down the hall next to him. And I said, all right. I said, are they there? And he said, yes. So I figured that's a pretty good place to start.
Right.
And I'm flying down this hallway. And as I'm flying down, I see a door and the door says chief medical officer. And I think, oh, that might be a place to start. And I put my hand on the door handle, assuming it would be locked, but it wasn't. And I open the door and walk in this tiny little room, no windows. And there was a doctor sitting there at his desk and looked at me with complete terror. Reasonably, at that point, I was out of my mind.
Crazy eyed dad is just standing there. Yes. You know, you might have come off the psychiatric ward. Who knows? You know,
right? And I said to him, "You can call security, but just give me 2 minutes." And as I was talking, he went onto his computer and dug her up and looked at her vitals and looked at least a cursory look at her history to see that she had been discharged 12 hours earlier. He was the first doctor to lay hands on her. And he had, you know, that was not his job. But he changed the entire trajectory of her care. She was considered a special, given special treatment. I was given special treatment because in the first few weeks she was readmitted, she couldn't call for assistance at night. Right. She could, and she could certainly couldn't get to the bathroom without assistance. And I watched nurses treat her poorly. And so I said to the doc, I'm spending the night with her every night. And I did for a month, 8 to 8. And that was against hospital rules. By the end of that month, every security officer in the building knew me and knew I had permission, special permission. And the fact is, I helped her that because there were times when, you know, she would try to eat and the food would fall out of her hands and there was nobody was going to help her if I wasn't there. I belong to a support group that focuses on parents enabling children and the problems. And I'm certainly guilty of it, but this didn't feel like enabling to me. It still doesn't. She was discharged from there.
She got proper care.
As she was discharged from there to a hospital that specializes in short-term stroke recovery, she did great. She was returned to detox. And this is really when Marchman kicked in because she assumed that she was going to sort of graduate from detox and then return to the world. And at this point, we're probably 60 days beyond her death, and she's nowhere near, I mean, a million miles away, ready for that. So we found should I give the name of the program?
Please. Absolutely.
Right. There's a long-term, because my daughter has been at this so long, I am pretty familiar with lots of programs because we have been customers of lots of programs. But I have never heard of Burning Tree, which is outside of Dallas, Texas. And it is for, they self-described, a program for late-term addicts, meaning addicts who are on the verge of death. And certainly my daughter qualified for that.
Multiple relapses and multiple treatment experiences and complex behaviors and co-occurring mental health issues, the whole nine yards. Burning Tree, that's where they specialize. Yeah.
And I spent a week, I assumed that they would automatically admit her because she was so obviously, she so obviously fit their profile. I spent a lot of time on their website. And they wanted, basically, I had to qualify, not just her, but me in particular and the family, because the ethos there is this is a family disease. She didn't get there alone. And if she's going to get better, all of you need to get better and you need to commit. And I signed a contract with them that I am honoring that says I'm doing my own recovery. I'm doing my own 12 step, which has never really fit for me personally, but I'm doing it. And there are things that I'm learning and benefiting from. It was very frustrating because if Burning Tree didn't take her, I had no idea what was going to happen.
I want to put a cap on the hospital experience a little bit, and I'll share a personal one that I have. And part of what led me to get into this work, though at the time I didn't know it, I was pretty young, got hit by a car while on my bike, and ended up in a pretty small hospital in Virginia. And I was anemic when I was a teenager. So my blood count was pretty low. So I just had an accident. I'd gone to the hospital. My mom drove immediately up. My mom's a nurse. And or was at the Times, and walks into the hospital, and they're going to do exploratory surgery because they're uncertain as to why my blood count is so low. And my mom walks into the hospital, and this is one of the things just salient in my mind. She just snaps the clipboard out of the doctor's hand. If you knew my mom, you'd know, like, that's her in a nutshell. It's like, he's anemic. That's why his stupid blood count's low. You're going to kill him. Sign me out AMA and drove me home. And I recovered. Like, I was not as injured as they thought I might be. Thank God. Another miracle, but literally saved my life, because she pulled kind of what you pulled. You know, this, like, I demand satisfaction, and I demand it right now. And I think that part of the story that is beautiful about what you're telling, and something I think that people need to hear, is that just because you're with someone who is a quote unquote professional, just because you're with someone who's got credentials and the doctorate and everything else, does not mean that they know everything, that they've paid attention to what is going on, and that you shouldn't advocate yourself for yourself. It's you need to walk in prepared to know what is needed, to talk to an administrator, to tell the doctor that this is not right and I want better care. And if you don't, then I'm going to call my attorneys. Do whatever you got to do to get the care that you need, because it can go south, and it can go south quickly. And then, of course, you know, the other thing I'd like to point out is, you know, something that people, they end up finding us, and thank goodness they do, but not everybody does. You were a person who'd been through treatment experiences, and you'd been through this many, many years at this point, and became aware of the field of residential treatment, became aware of what quality programming looked like, and found something that was a resource for you. And thank God, you know what I mean? Because so many people are out there just shooting in the dark. And I know that you've run into it in your experience, but there are bad actors out there. And one of the indicators that you found a good actor is, like, no, you're the parent and you're going to be in on this recovery process. And that is a key factor to a good program that knows what they're doing, that makes sure that family involvement is there.
I'm a veteran of at least 20 different programs. Okay. I have never had so much demanded and expected of me. And it's correct. As I think about it, it's appropriate. And it actually, in some ways, is a relief, because rather than a bystander, I get to participate. And I want to participate, even though my level of participation is saying no over and over and over again. Saying no has been hard for me. And Burning Tree correctly ascertained that in my family, I'm the weak link. They spent a lot. They had no problems figuring that my wife would say no. And they had no problems figuring that I would have trouble with it. And in fact, they had what they call a post-admission intervention, where they called us down to Burning Tree. They did not let us enter the it's a campus, it's a ranch. They did not let us enter the grounds. There's a building right at the gate. And she didn't know we were there. And we sat with an interventionist who spent 2 hours finding out and really, really pushing us about where our boundaries were. They explained that if she walked, it was not realistic to think that she would actually physically walk from Burning Tree, because it's not in the middle of nowhere, but you can see it from there. It's down a dirt road connected to it.
Yep, I know exactly what you're talking about.
All right, so she is not going to physically walk out, but she can demand.
Well, and even if you do, it's a long walk to anything else.
That's not my daughter, but she could demand to leave, and after 48 hours, they would oblige her by taking her to Dallas's toughest homeless shelter and dropping her off. And that's got to be a pretty tough homeless shelter. Not that any are not tough, but that's got to be really tough. And so I was, they pushed me. What happens when you get a call from the homeless shelter and it's your daughter and she wants $20 for dinner or an airplane ticket home or something